Hello, my name's John Dennis. It's Wednesday, the 25th of February. Today, Barack Obama makes his first speech as president to Congress. Also today, an architect of the UK's security and intelligence policy spells out in stark terms why we need to sacrifice our rights to privacy to aid the fight against terrorism.
It's what I call the Kenny Everett clause in this matter, which is you can propose to do some of the most nastiest, offensive things possible as long as you do it all in the best possible taste.
And Facebook is bad for your health, according to one of the country's leading neuroscientists.
If you define friend as just saying, hi, how are you? I'm getting up, I'm cleaning my teeth. That's a rather self-centred way of talking to someone. It's not actually interacting. It's not actually getting to know that person.
And has the photographer Annie Leibovitz fallen victim to the credit crunch?
She has given the copyright to all her photographs to this one company called Art Capital, which in turn has lent her about $15 million. So it's kind of a substantial story, I think.
Guardian Daily with John Dennis on guardian.co.uk.
Before we hear about any of that, let's have the news headlines and a flick through the papers with Bill Overton.
In his first address to a joint session of Congress, President Barack Obama's promised Americans suffering from the economic crisis that he'll lead the country from a dire day of reckoning to a brighter future. Addressing a full chamber of lawmakers and a nationwide television audience Tuesday night, the president balanced a somber assessment of the United States' economic woes with a revival of the words of hope that were the trademark of his presidential campaign.
The impact of this recession is real, and it is everywhere. But while our economy may be weakened and our confidence shaken, though we are living through difficult and uncertain times, tonight I want every American to know this. We will rebuild, we will recover, and the United States of America will emerge stronger than before.
The increase in council tax will not be as high as expected, as local councils seek to help recession-hit families. The rise will be 3%, amounting to an extra 79 pence a week. The Local Government Association chairman says councils are working flat out to keep taxes down. Local authority revenues are expected to drop by £2.5 billion in the next financial year, and many councils have been cutting jobs and non-essential services. The lesser increase would bring the average council bill for 2009 to 2010 to £1,414. Meanwhile, the government's rejected plans to allow train companies to raise fares, causing concern among some train operators. The Rail Minister, Lord Adonis, has told train companies that he'll not reverse a looming drop in ticket prices. The rail industry has reacted with dismay to the news. Lord Adonis will confirm the cap in fares when he appears before the Transport Select Committee today. One of the architects of the government's national security strategies warned that privacy rights of innocent people will have to be sacrificed to give the security services access to a sweeping range of personal data. The former Whitehall Security and Intelligence Coordinator, Sir David Omond, in a paper outlined how the way the state will mine data held by public and private bodies, including travel information, phone records and emails. He said that finding out other people's secrets is going to involve breaking everyday moral rules. His paper provides the most candid assessment yet of the scale of Whitehall's ambitions for a state database to track terrorist groups. It argues that while the measures are essential, public trust will be maintained only if such intrusive surveillance is carried out within a strong framework of morality and human rights. And finally, it's emerged that the reality television star Jade Goody pleaded with doctors to help her die after being told her cervical cancer was terminal. Goody's told OK magazine her immediate reaction to the devastating diagnosis was to just give up. She reveals she begged for a pill or lethal injection to put a stop to her suffering so her two sons could get on with their lives. Goody's cancer has spread to her liver, groin and bowel, and she's been given just weeks to live. She married her fiancé Jack Tweed on Sunday. All that and more at guardian.co.uk, but first, a look at the papers this morning. The Daily Mail wonders what the Cabinet papers on the decision to invade Iraq contain after their release was blocked by the Justice Minister Jack Straw. Senior Army officers tell The Independent that soldiers in Afghanistan are fighting jihadists from Britain. Some intercepted Taliban communications have revealed some jihadists in Helmand province speak with West Midlands accents. The cap on rail fares heads the Times, while the Financial Times highlights the tense discussion over bank bailouts between the Chancellor and the financial institutions. And Jade Goody's death wish upon hearing her cancer was terminal tops The Sun and The Daily Mirror.
Finding out other people's secrets is going to involve breaking everyday moral rules. That's what Sir David Omand, he's the government's former security and intelligence coordinator, has warned in a pamphlet for the think tank, the Institute for Public Policy Research. He says our rights to privacy are going to have to be sacrificed for the sake of national security. With the details is our Home Affairs editor, Alan Travis.
It's an interesting paper on the future of national security strategy. And Sir David Omand is a former security and intelligence coordinator at the Cabinet Office and a career civil servant who used to, and therefore as such, as a kind of key architect of the national security strategy as it exists now. And what he's saying is that all the information that resides about us in the numerous databases around the place now, mainly for benign purposes, whether it's when we go abroad, advanced passenger information that's logged on the government's e-borders network, or it's about other travel data, passport, biometric data, immigration, identity, border records, criminal records, other data such as financial and telephone and communication records, that all now adds up into an extremely useful and vital resource for the police and the national security services in terms of trying to track down terrorists and potential serious crime suspects. And he thinks it's very important that the police and security services understand that they can have access to this personal data, often sensitive personal data, and can use such new sophisticated sort of data mining techniques, data matching, they call it, whereby they can build up a profile of somebody and put together a whole profile of their movements, activities and associates based upon that data which currently resides in all these different databases. And what's interesting about it is that he's a quite a serious figure in the intelligence security world, and he's in a very candid way setting out the kind of scale of Whitehall's ambition for that what has been called and labelled as the database state.
And what does he say about safeguards to our privacy? Innocent people for the most part.
Well, he says in the past, traditional police methods have been about seeking out evidence about a named suspect already justified by a reasonable suspicion of having a crime. But what this new data means is that they have to trawl through huge mounds of personal data which belong to the innocent as well as the guilty in order to be able to build up a picture of who's likely to be caught in the net, so to speak. And he's quite candid about that and open about that, about the privacy issues that involved. But he says it's better and to understand that some privacy is going to have to be compromised and sacrificed in order to maintain and keep up with the bad guys who are using this new technology in order to try and keep one step ahead. And it's better to do that, he argues, than compromising the rule of law or fundamental human rights. So he's thought about this quite a lot, and he thinks, you know, you can do it in a human rights and an ethical framework, if you like. It's what I call the Kenny Everett clause in this matter, which is you can propose to do some of the most nastiest, offensive things possible as long as you do it all in the best possible taste. So he's proposing the kind of safeguards that there must be, it must be proportionate to the seriousness of the crimes that are involved. So, you know, no more of this local authorities using Reaper surveillance cameras in order to control fly tippers and people who are sending their kids to the wrong school. It's got to be serious, it's got to be proportionate, it's got to be about an integrity of motive, that the public are concerned that the intelligence authorities and the police are acting with integrity.
Alan Travis, and there's full details of that story today at guardian.co.uk/UK. Also on The Guardian's website, David Cameron at the crossroads. Andy Beckett writes at guardian.co.uk/politics. Mike Lee's Oscars diary is at guardian.co.uk/film. And Sam Leith interviews Andrea Corr ahead of her stage debut at guardian.co.uk/arts. Social networking sites such as Facebook and Bebo are changing children's brains, according to a leading neuroscientist. She says using these sites has no cohesive narrative or long-term significance. And as a result, the 21st century mind has a shorter attention span and craves instant sensation. That's what Lady Susan Greenfield, Professor of Synaptic Pharmacology at Lincoln College, Oxford, and Director of the Royal Institution, has told the House of Lords. She says social networking sites damage children's ability to empathise.
We actually know now that the environment can actually influence the connections between your brain cells, so that as you have individual experiences, the brilliant thing about being born a human being is that you have individual brain cell connections. And my concern or my interest is that if you change the environment radically, as you might if you're spending long hours in front of a screen, and especially if you're having your primary socializing in the form of virtual relationships, that that might create the kind of mindset or drive the kind of brain connections that have been unprecedented. Whether they're good or bad is for other people to judge, but they may just be different, and we should try and think about how they might be different.
And is this just social network sites or other websites as well?
No, my own view would be that social networking is particularly relevant and important because relationships are particularly relevant and important, and all human beings engage in them. But I would extend screen life, if you like, and the issues of living, for want of a better word, in two dimensions, to games, to how you solve problems, how you understand things, how you learn things, as well as how you relate to other people.
Don't social networking sites enhance interaction between people? You know, they allow us to keep in touch and to interact in useful and enjoyable ways.
Well, it's very interesting. It does actually question what a friendship is. I met someone once who said he had 900 friends. Now, the type of friendships I have, I can only have about 10 in my life. I only have time for about 10 friends. That's to say, people you talk at length with over the phone or go for walks with or lend money to or ring up in the middle of the night. And I don't think you could do that with 900 people because you don't have enough time to get to know that person and to get to know them as they roll through their life, as they go through their life story. If you define friend as just saying, hi, how are you? I'm getting up, I'm cleaning my teeth. That's a rather self-centered omission, if you like, or way of talking to someone. It's not actually interacting. It's not actually getting to know that person in depth. How can it be? Because you don't have the time to do that.
Is this based on your suspicions, Lady Greenfield, as a leading neuroscientist, or is it actually based on evidence that's actually been collated?
No, the whole point of my making the speech in the House of Lords was to draw attention to this issue and to hope that people will start to set up investigations or start research into this. At the moment, one can only look indirectly, for example, at the threefold increase in drugs for attention deficit disorders that have occurred over the last 10 years, to the increase in autism, where people have a lack of empathy for others, and perhaps investigate whether the two are in any way related to screen life or to a sustained screen life. So it's not that one has evidence and therefore, you know, I'm just simply saying that screen life causes this to happen or to become a certain type of person. But depending on what kind of person you want the next generation to be, all I'm saying is we should explore how the screen can be harder to deliver that. At the moment, I think we're sleepwalking into these technologies, and assuming everything will shake down just fine, I think really we need to have a collective debate to discuss how best we can take things forward.
Can I just throw at you a quote from Boris Johnson in yesterday's Telegraph, not talking about this specifically, but he says, every generation is phobic about the effect of new technology on the morals of the next. Yeah. What do you think of that?
Well, it's a bit of a sweeping statement, and I think this is different from previous generations. Criticisms I have are people saying, oh, well, the television or rock and roll in the middle of the 20th century, people were frightened of that. But I point out that people have danced forever and that in a way, in the middle of the 20th century, the TV was more analogous to Victorians gathered around a piano where it was part of family life. You'd talk and discuss things and interact while watching the telly. This is the first time, the very first time, that grown-up adult human beings have spent their precious money and leisure time playing games all on their own, just for the sake of playing games all on their own. The first time ever that's happened. So I think this is different. And also, it's more pervasive than ever before. And people are spending more time indulging in the screen world than they would have previously spent rock and rolling or watching TV or engaging in the earlier technologies.
Susan Greenfield.
Guardian Daily. News and reports from around the world.
My name's John Dennis. Still to come in Guardian Daily, why, despite the recession, sales of Palestinian olive oil are soaring.
In a way, this is a window to connect with the rest of the world.
But first, Annie Leibovitz, the photographer, has reportedly borrowed more than $15 million from a company called Art Capital. She's used the rights to all her photographs, past, present and future, as collateral, according to the New York Times. Art Capital is the equivalent of a high-end pawn shop for art collectors. Ed Pilkington is in New York.
Well, the New York Times has a story this morning which looks at, it's an old but burgeoning form of, you might call it, high-class pawn shop. It's where people with art collections, private art collections, or fine art or photography collections, take it to what are essentially mini banks, and they loan them to the banks, and in return they're lent a lot of money. So it's like a pawn shop. You give them your assets, they lend you money, and eventually you hope to get your assets back again. In the case of Annie Leibovitz, it's not only her own collection, it's her own work as a very famous photographer who works for Vanity Fair and who's taken portraits of many of the world's most famous people. She has a very, very valuable set of copyright photographs and negatives. And she, according to New York Times, which based its story upon public records that you can get here in New York, has given the copyright, the entire copyright, to all her photographs to this one company called Art Capital, which in turn has lent her against the value of those copyrighted photographs and also against some of her homes. She has a few homes around New York and Long Island, has lent her about $15 million. So it's kind of a substantial story, I think.
Do we know why she's felt the need to do this?
No, we don't really. I mean, all we do know is that she's had a pretty volatile few years. Her longtime partner Susan Sontag recently died, as did her parents. She also now has three children, one of her own, and then she had twins by surrogate mother in 2005. So she has three kids to look after. But we don't really know what would have tipped her into needing to borrow very, very substantial amount of money. The Times mentions that she might have paid off some of her mortgages, but it's a bit of a mystery, that side of it.
She's not the only well-known client to have approached Art Capital.
No, and indeed, not only Art Capital, there are several of these companies based in New York and around America that specialise in lending out money against fine art and other forms of art. And they're all reporting a bit of a spike since the recession began. This is sort of one of the very few growth areas that are bucking the trend in the recession, because, of course, people are desperate for money. Art Capital I spoke to, I went to see them this morning, to see their offices, which are like an art gallery in themselves. They show sort of fine art from the 17th century, some very modern works, and a set of photographs by a New York photographer called Haas, all of which have been pawned. And so what they're saying is that they've seen maybe a 30 or 40% increase in people coming through to their doors, including a lot of hedge fund managers who, as we know, are in a lot of trouble themselves and who have brought in their very, very luxurious art collections in, and has set them into this corporation in return for millions of dollars of lending.
And do most of Art Capital's customers repay their loans?
They say they have defaults in about 10%, one in 10 of the cases, and they insist they're very, very keen to avoid defaulting. They say it's not in their own interest whatsoever, apart from the emotional fallout that you get when someone defaults. You often get a lot of legal actions as well, because people claim that they've been harshly treated. And that really where their money comes from is in the interest rates. They charge, you know, high rates, between 8 and 18% of interest, and that's where they make their money. So they're very, very keen not to get into defaulting situations. And, you know, if they're right, it's only one in 10 of cases.
Ed, many thanks. There's been a sharp increase in the sales of Palestinian olive oil produced on the West Bank since the Israeli military offensive in Gaza. Nasser Abu Farha chairs the Palestinian Fair Trade Association, and he's touring Britain to promote the first ever Fair Trade Palestinian olive oil. He spoke to The Guardian's Mark Tran.
Palestine has an ancient presence of the olive tree in Palestine. They grow in hills separated by a great biodiversity, allows for sunlight and flow of air, so maintained organically. And these trees produce an olive that gives an aromatic olive oil, very flavorful, fruity, and has a peppery taste that lingers in the mouth for a long, surprising time after the taste.
How important is it for Palestinian olive oil to win the fair trade label?
We are very excited and very pleased to be the first olive oil in the world to win the fair trade label. And this is very crucial to the Palestinian farmers, an important accomplishment. It's a culmination of 4 years of fair trade building and cooperative building in Palestine. And it touches people's lives in many ways. It touches farmers' lives in the fact that it increases their income, and this certification will widen the distribution of this fair trade olive oil more than what it has been so far. And so it would allow us to touch more people's lives in Palestine. And also culturally important. In a way, this is a window to connect with the rest of the world. This olive oil is a bond between Palestinian producers and the people who are ethical consumers seeking social impact from the product they consume.
Now, what impact has the recent Israeli offensive in Gaza, what impact has it had on sales of Palestinian olive oil?
Gaza, for the olive oil industry at least, in Palestine, represents a market because there isn't enough production of olive oil in Gaza Strip like in the West Bank. So Gaza has always been a good market for some of the olive oil that's produced in the West Bank, and this year has been denied access for the Palestinian farmers. So the farmers who used to sell their olive oil to Gaza are still holding on to their farm, to their oil, and they haven't sold any of it. So certainly that's a loss of market. That means a loss of income for our farmers.
I gather that because of the conflict, there's been consumer support, if you like, for sales of Palestinian olive oil.
Yes, absolutely. I think our buyers in the UK and in Europe are witnessing remarkable increase in demand for Palestinian olive oil. Our buyers in the UK have had threefold increase in sales. We have a buyer in the Netherlands who have basically sold the container before the container arrived. They had enough orders from shops that were very excited, eagerly waiting for the product to arrive. So certainly there is a lot of excitement about Palestinian products and a lot of interest in supporting Palestinian communities through the product.
It's carnival season in Brazil, and Olinda's Carnival has all the party atmosphere of Rio de Janeiro or Salvador, but without the price tag. Ed Ewing hooks up with fellow couch surfers for the biggest night of celebrations.
Olinda is a colonial town a few miles north of the industrial city of Recife. It's a UNESCO World Heritage Site and looks across the bay towards downtown Recife. The party starts on Friday and lasts for 4 days in both cities. Recife and Olinda claim they have the best carnival because it's free and it's all outside. They say Rio Carnival is too commercial and made for TV. Tickets to the Sambadrome to see the famous parade can cost hundreds of pounds for the best seats. And Salvador in Bahia, which is the aficionados' alternative to Rio, is going the same way. Tickets to follow the sound systems through the streets cost £90. But Recife and Olinda are free, outside, and everyone can take part. They are also, in the most part, friendly and safe. Luciana Freitas is a 28-year-old teacher from Recife. Using social networking websites, he's invited a dozen visitors to stay with him and his friends in his two-bedroom house in the south of the city. There are two French backpackers here, a couple of British people, and half a dozen people from Bahia.
I believe it is one of the best because it has different types of people, different types of rhythms and dance. You can do everything that you want. It depends not just of the carnival, but depends on the people who you are and the environment. You can feel the atmosphere of happiness and people, especially who are foreigners in our carnival, can feel it.
And why have you opened your house up?
Because I believe that's a good idea to make friendship and exchange language, exchange knowledge. I believe by the time you have a community like Couchsurfing, you can meet people around and see them what you have and also spread our culture. And by the time you do that, you can also extend their culture. It's important nowadays in times of globalization, and it's important for humanity, I believe.
And Marcus Vinicius has travelled up from Bahia, home of Brazil's second biggest carnival, because he doesn't like how commercial the Salvador carnival has become.
Recife is a quite big city, and big cities nowadays, you can see people living from each other, from the relationships, and try to be more selfish. Oh. And you can't find it here.
You don't find it here?
No, right now. Maybe because it's carnival. Mm. I want to see the city after the carnival to make a...
So you're from Bahia, and how far away is that? How many hours travel?
21.
And why did you come up to Recife instead of... Because Salvador has a big carnival, so why did you come?
Yeah. Salvador is a different kind of carnival. In Salvador, you got ropes to separate people who can pay for the carnival from that ones who don't have any money, but they want to go to party. Mm. So it's very sad to see that. So in here, you don't find this. You don't need to pay to see great people singing to go to the party. You don't have to pay to enjoy.
Ed Ewing reporting. Pete Sale and Roxanne Escobales produced today's edition of Guardian Daily. My name's John Dennis. Thanks for listening.